Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 27. I will entitle this chapter, Job Continues, I Will Maintain My Integrity. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 26, Job exalts the majesty of God and the righteousness of God because he wants to make it clear that in his complaint against God, he's not complaining against God's justice. He's complaining about the fact that God won't explain to him why he's suffering for something that he didn't do. Job continues with that same line of thought here in chapter 27 by telling his three false friends, look, God is great, God is good, and he punishes the wicked. Ultimately, I grant you that. But he doesn't punish them all the time and in every case. And he doesn't punish me because I am not doing anything or have not done anything wicked to justify all my suffering. So we start down Job 27 verses 1 through 6. Then Job continued his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty, who has embittered my soul, for as long as life is in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips certainly will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue mutter deceit. Far be it from me that I should declare you right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days. Now, basically, to summarize these six verses, Job is saying, God is just and I have integrity. I don't know how to reconcile the two things, but I didn't do anything to deserve this. And I'm not saying that God is unjust for letting it happen to me. I'm not going either way with that. Now, Job is speaking here in verse 27. It's actually Zophar's turn to speak because Eliphaz would go first, Eliphaz the Temanite, and then Bildad the Shuhite would go second, and then Zophar the Naamathite would go third. Well, Bildad had just tapped out in two chapters ago, in chapter 25. He only spoke for six verses talking about how great God was, the implication being God is great, God is righteous, and Job, you're not righteous, and you're not great because you are opposing him with your unconfessed sin. But he just went for six verses and quit. And now that's the last we hear. Bildad was finished, and now it's Zophar's time to speak, and Zophar doesn't say anything. So Job's going to have the floor from now on for a while. Job starts out in verse 2 and says, as God lives. Now, we don't need to just brush over that little phrase. That's a serious oath, as God lives. It's an oath that you see a lot in the Old Testament. Every time I see it, I keep thinking of the Amish and the Mennonites who think that somehow it's a sin to take an oath before God. It is not a sin. It's a sin to take a rash oath or an oath that you mean to get out of by deceit, but a serious oath is perfectly okay scripturally. And Job takes a serious oath here. As God lives, who has taken away my right. The NIV translates that as who has denied me justice. Job thinks that God inexplicably has become unjust toward him, but he still believes in God utterly. He will not trash God's justice. Job saw no justice, and yet he still believed. And is that not the classic definition of faith? Believing without seeing. Faith is the substance of things not seen. Job could not see the justice of God, but he still believed in it. Actually, the problem here was a matter of timing. God did behave justly towards Job at the end. He gave him all of his stuff back, and he proclaimed him innocent before his friends. So God was just, but Job couldn't see it. Not yet. And so he says, God has taken away my right and embittered my soul. He's blaming God for this. Now remember also, Job did not realize that God had told Satan to do all this stuff to Job as a test. Job didn't realize that, so he just assumed God was doing it. He was wrong about that. Adam Clark says, there appears to be a great want of reverence in these words of Job. He speaks with a degree of irritation, if not bitterness, which cannot be justified. No man should speak thus of his Maker. And I agree with that. But I cut Job some slack. I've never suffered quite as much as Job has. He probably shouldn't have expressed his quote-unquote irritation with God. However, I must say that looking at the situation objectively, it did look like the Almighty had taken away Job's right. It did look like that because God would not explain to Job what was going on. But Job never said that God was unjust. Now, another thing he says is, I'm not going to admit that my false friends are right and that I've sinned. He says in verse 4, my lips certainly will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue mutter deceit. Far be it from me that I should declare you right. I'm not going to admit to you that I sinned. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I have done nothing to deserve this. I hold fast my righteousness. He's not claiming to be sinlessly perfect. He's basically saying, I didn't do anything to warrant all this suffering. I'm righteous in as far as my current situation is. He's not claiming to be like Adam before Adam ate the fruit. Verse 6, Job says, my heart does not reproach any of my days. I didn't do anything wrong, guys. And I don't care how bad it looks, I'm not going to admit that to you. He says, as long as the breath of God is in his nostrils, he's not going to admit that to his false friends. The breath of God, of course, is his life, his spirit. As long as life is in me, verse 3, and the breath of God is in me, that's a parallel there. Breath of God is his life. Now we go to Job 27, verses 7 through 10. Job continues, may my enemy be as the wicked and my opponent as the unjust. For what is the hope of the godless when he is cut off, when God requires his life? Will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? Will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call on God at all times? Now, verse 7, Job says, may my enemy be as the wicked. Now, who is his enemy? Well, here are some options. John Gill says it perhaps could refer to Job himself, and Job would thereby be wishing that all of his enemies, including the three false friends, were as righteous as Job was. So what Job would be saying in verse 7 is, may my enemy be as the wicked man, quote unquote, the wicked man that you accuse me of being. May my enemy be as that wicked man, miserable, scraping boils with no property and more kids. And let my opponent be as this quote unquote unjust man that you say that I am, scraping boils without property and without children. And of course, then Job would basically be saying, I hope you three guys end up like me. Well, to take it that way, you have to say that the word wicked and unjust is taken in an ironic sense. I don't like to do that unless absolutely necessary, because it's not clear. Sarcasm's hard to detect sometimes. So I would prefer to take it as a straight-out imprecation on God, on Job's enemies, like the Chaldeans who destroyed Job's camels, and the Sabaeans who took his oxes and donkeys, and who killed Job's servants, and of course, Job's enemies, straightforward. Job's enemies are his three false friends. It sounds to me like Job's going on the offense now. He's saying, may you end up like me, you scum buckets. John Gill suggests that you could translate this differently and say, instead of there being an imprecation, may this happen to my enemies, it could be just a prediction. My enemy shall be as the wicked. In other words, you three guys are going to end up like wicked people do. Well, I think that what Job is saying is, I hope you three guys get nailed, that you end up as the wicked and the unjust, because I do believe that the wicked and the unjust will suffer punishment, even though you claim that I don't believe that. I do believe that, and I hope you end up like they do, judged, punished. Now, that would lead me into a rabbit trail. Is it okay to pray for harm for one's enemies? Job says, may my enemy be as the wicked, judged like the wicked man. Is it okay to pray that way? Well, the NIV Study Bible says, no, it's not. That Study Bible claims that not everything a Bible character does should be imitated, and of course that's true. And then the NIV Study Bible quotes the old chestnut, Matthew 5:44. Jesus says, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. So, open and shut case, right? You're not supposed to pray for your enemies that bad things happen to them, and Job is therefore sinning when he does this? Well, how about this? How about when your enemy has not practice justice towards you, and you're just looking for justice, not personal revenge now, but just justice, objective justice? Or how about when your enemy is going to harm someone else? You're not supposed to do anything about that? We're supposed to be pacifist? Well, I could give you David's imprecatory psalms. Of course, the NIV Study Bible could say, well, that's an Old Testament character. We're not supposed to imitate what he does. Well, let's see what Jesus says in Luke 22, verse 36. And he, Jesus, said to his disciples, but now whoever has a money belt is to take it along, likewise also a bag, and whoever has no sword is to sell his coat and buy one. Why would Jesus ask his disciples to buy a sword as they prepared to go out on a mission trip? To whack criminals with, that's why. Well, what's worse? Imprecating an enemy or whacking him with a sword? And that's Jesus, and that's the New Testament. This is another one of my favorite verses for pacifist. John 18, verses 22 through 23. Jesus has been arrested. He's standing, I forgot which court he was in, Annas or Caiaphas, one of the two high priests. And we read in verse 22 of John 18, when Jesus had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, is that the way you answer the high priest? So Jesus was slapped in the face. Verse 23, Jesus answered him, If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong, but if rightly, why do you strike me? So did Jesus just turn the other cheek when he was blasted, when he was slapped? No, he did not. The Sermon on the Mount, talking about not going after your enemies, is talking about private revenge. It is not talking about judicial acts of either the police, as in Romans 13. It's not talking about the police functions of a state. It's talking about personal revenge. We're not supposed to have personal revenge. But if you need justice, there's nothing wrong with praying for justice. And so I don't blame Job here. He's being attacked, and he needs justice. And he's going to get it, too, because God's going to nail Eliphaz and company at the end of this book. All right, so what's going to happen to the unjust, as the three false friends of Job clearly are? What's going to happen to them? Verse 8, what is the hope of the godless when he is cut off? Now, is Job particularly talking about the three false friends, or is he just talking in general terms about the godless? I don't know, but I tend to think that he is aiming personally at Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. What is the hope of you three guys when you are cut off, when God requires your life? Will God hear your cry when distress comes upon you? I'm changing the him to you. It actually reads, Will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him, the godless? Will he, the godless, take delight in the Almighty? Will he call on God at all times? So Job, in my opinion, is cleverly turning around the argument. He's saying, okay, Zophar, Bildad, and Eliphaz, you keep saying that the wicked will be punished. I agree with you, and you're wicked, and you're going to get punished for what you're doing to me. Well, I might be wrong about that interpretation, but we can at least hold to this fact, is that Job believes that the godless will suffer punishment. Verse 8, for what is the hope of the godless when he is cut off, when God requires his life? And Job is not worried about God judging him as a sinner because he knows he didn't sin. So Job is not putting himself in the category of the godless. He's putting his enemies, I think, in the category of the godless. And he's saying, you guys better watch out. We go now to Job 27, verses 11 through 17. Job continues speaking to his three false friends. I will teach you about God's power. I will not conceal what the Almighty has planned. All of you have seen this for yourselves. Why do you keep up this empty talk? This is a wicked man's lot from God, the inheritance the ruthless receive from the Almighty. Even if his children increase, they are destined for the sword. His descendants will never have enough food. Those who survive him will be buried by the plague, yet their widows will not weep for them. Though he piles up silver like dust and heaps up a wardrobe like clay, he may heap it up, but the righteous will wear it, and the innocent will divide up his silver. Verse 11, Job says, I will teach you about God's power. The NASB has, I will teach you in God's power. In other words, clothed with God's power, I'm coming to you to teach you. I don't think that's what it is. I think it's the NIV. In the Home of Christian Study Bible, translation is better. I will teach you about God's power. I will not conceal what the Almighty has planned. So Job is being very confident. He's speaking for God, and he is going to talk about the fate of the wicked in this life. It's not total innocence, as he was saying before, but he is saying that sometimes the wicked get judged, and sometimes, as he says in previous chapters, sometimes the wicked prosper. Job's position is a one of nuance. It's not black and white. Verse 12, all of you have seen this for yourselves. Job appeals to common experience. What happens to bad people? So why do you keep blabbing away with your empty talk about how wicked the wicked get punished? You don't need to do that. I can see it. You can see it. You can look around and see it. This is a wicked man's lot from God. This is what he gets from God, the Almighty. Even if his children increase, they're destined for the sword. So yes, we do see the wicked punishment. His descendants will never have enough food. Those who survive him will be buried by the plague. Yet their widows will not weep for them. Why will the widows not weep? Well, perhaps too they have died in the plague. Perhaps they have been forbidden to lament their husbands because their husbands died a shameful death. Or maybe they were just hit with so much stupor at the sight of their husband's death, they couldn't weep. They were just in shock. That's why they didn't weep for their husbands. Verse 16, though he piles up silver like dust. Dust is very common. And if you have a lot of silver, you have a lot of silver as much as you have dust. In other words, even though the unrighteous man is very rich, and if he heaps up a wardrobe like clay, back then clothes were considered wealth. What does that say in the New Testament? Don't lay up for yourselves treasures where the moth corrupts. Treasures would be clothes, fancy clothes. You heap up all your clothes like clay. Clay is a very common piece of dirt. And so the wealthy man has as many clothes as there is dirt on the ground. It doesn't matter how much wealth you've got, because you're not going to get to keep it. Righteous will wear it, and the innocent will divide up his silver. The money is going to pass out of his family and end up in the hands of righteous people. So there is justice in the universe. Now, I must say that this verse is quoted by certain Christians and saying, see there, Christians are going to all inherit the wealth of the unrighteous. You cannot make an absolute statement out of that. Sure, God sometimes does that, and Job is saying that. Sometimes he does that, but it doesn't mean it happens in every case. In fact, in previous chapters, Job has made a great point of saying that sometimes the wicked prosper. They don't leave their wealth to the innocent and the righteous, not all the time. The NIV Study Bible makes a point of that, and I make a point of it too. We turn now to Job chapter 27, verses 18 through 23. Job continues speaking of the unrighteous man. The house he, that's the unrighteous man, the house he built is like a moth's cocoon or a booth set up by a watchman. He lies down, the unrighteous man does, lies down wealthy, but will do so no more. When he opens his eyes, it is gone. What's gone? All of his wealth is gone, or the house that he built is gone. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A storm wind sweeps him away at night. An east wind picks him up, and he is gone. It carries him away from his place. It blasted him without mercy while he flees desperately from its grasp. It claps its hand at him and scorns him from its place. Verse 18, Job says the house that the unrighteous man builds is like a moth's cocoon. The NASB has like a spider's web. Well, no matter how you translate it, the point is the house is temporary. A spider's web only lasts for a night. I've seen plenty of them in my country place. They go up one night and they're gone the next. The booth set up by a watchman, the NASB translates booth as hut, and this refers to huts put up in sheep pastures or an orchard or a vineyard so that the shepherds or the orchard tenders can have a place of temporary shelter so they can look over the crops or over the flock. And it's a hut, not meant to stay there permanently. And so the point is the rich man's house is not permanent. It's very temporary, just like his wealth is. He opens his eyes, it's gone. When does he open his eyes? Coming up from sleep, maybe, but most probably. It's talking about when he lies down and dies. And then when he opens his eyes in the afterlife, whoa, can't take it with you when you go. Terrors overtake him like a flood. That's referring to dying. Storm wind sweeps him away at night. A storm wind sweeps him away at night. Again, that's talking about the rich man's going to die. And this is a great metaphor here in verse 21. An east wind picks him up. Now, what's this east wind? That's the sirocco, the famous sirocco. A blistering wind off the desert. The same wind that collapsed the house where Job's children were feasting in 119 and wiped out his 10 children. Now, if you recall, Job is operating in the Arabian Desert in the land of Uz, which is somewhere between the Jordan River and the Euphrates River in the Arabian Desert. Now, wind blows from the east off that desert, so wherever Job was, the wind would be coming from the east, and it's because the wind comes off the desert, it's extremely hot. Now, this is what John Gill says about that sirocco, the east wind. They who have breathed that wind fall instantly dead upon the place, though sometimes they have time to say that they burn within. No sooner does a man die by this wind, but he becomes as black as a coal. And if one take him by his leg, arm, or any other place, his flesh comes from the same and is plucked off by the hand that would lift him up. Now, that's pretty gruesome. You know you're dying because your lungs are burning inside of you, and then you fall dead instantly. And your flesh just rots off of your bones so that when people pick you up, your flesh comes off. So verse 22, this east wind blasted the unrighteous without mercy. The unrighteous man flees desperately from the grasp of the east wind. As you can see, why? Because it will kill you if you breathe it. Verse 23, the east wind, the sirocco, claps its hand at him. And that, of course, is a way to express scorn. This is poetic, a metaphor. Wind doesn't clap. It claps its hand at him at the unrighteous man and scorns him from its place. Now, in verse 22, when the east wind blasted the unrighteous man without mercy, that blast is probably thunder. Thunderbolts coming out of the east wind of the desert, out of the storm. Verse 23, the east wind claps its hands at him. The Holman Christian Study Bible has. The King James and the NASB has at men, makes it more impersonal. The sirocco claps its hands at men. But I like him better because it makes it more personal. The wind is coming after the unrighteous man personally. And verse 23 says, it claps its hand at him and scorns him. The NASB has it hisses at him. As Clark says, it seems it was an ancient method to clap the hands against and hiss a man from any public office who had acted improperly in it. I just saw a Texas Republican senator who, because of a political act of cowardice and stupidity, in my humble opinion, he is scheduled to speak at his Republican convention, his state convention, and they all started booing him so loudly he couldn't get a word out. And then he self-righteously gets on his Twitter account and says, I've never given in to the mob, yet I will not be intimidated by a mob. And I thought, that's great. The people who elected you and put you in office, you now are calling a mob. Oh, that's such gratitude. Well, if I'd have been there, instead of clapping my hands or booing, they wouldn't clap their hands, of course, because we boo now. But how about this? What if everybody in that room had just done this? Psst, just hissed at this senator like a snake. Ah, I can picture it now. I think it would be poetic justice and a great way to show your disgust with a weaselly politician who won't stand up for his constituents. But at any rate, that's a rabbit trail that's neither here nor there. We are now finished with Job 27. We need to remember the main point. Job is confessing, yes, I believe God is righteous. He will judge the unrighteous. But you still haven't answered me, friends. Why is he judging me? Because I'm not unrighteous. I haven't done anything to deserve this. And so we are now ready to go to Job chapter 28, verses 1 through 28. Job will continue his speech, and he's going to ask, where is wisdom? I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.